This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. This is the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to be with you today. Matt Patrick here. How great is Ellie? If you didn't listen, we'll have Ellie's interview, her show up on SoundCloud a little bit later on the webpage, right? On iTunes and all that good stuff?
Yep, I'm working on it right now.
Beautiful. It's good radio. It's good radio. We got good radio around here. We got Ellie, got Robert Pilot, Brett. It's good radio. Just enjoy. Pass it around. Tell your friends about it, too. So the big news that happened today was that basically in the middle of the night sometime, Georgia finally fessed up at that they actually went for Biden. Now, it's not by a lot of votes. There's going to be an instant recount. And there is a legit chance that that could actually go to Trump. It's when you look at recounts of major states, 1,500 votes is not a lot of votes. And if you really want to have a pretty much a confirmed win in a state with, say, 8-9 million people, you need to have 5,000 to 10,000 votes separating the two, because you might be able to make up a few votes here or there, but you're not going to make up too many. Needless to say, there could be a miscount, stuff like that. You know, Georgia could be, it could definitely go back to Trump, but right now that's in Biden's column. And then the big one, Pennsylvania, something we've been talking about all week long. They've been filing in the absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. And considering, and once again, the reason why they've been doing this is because the Pennsylvania state legislature ordered the state to not process any absentee ballots until after the polls closed. So they basically had all these absentee ballots they've been receiving early that they had to wait. And so now that's why it's taking so long. But they were almost all, I mean, the vast majority of them were from the metro areas, and so it was heavily Democratic, and well, that finally flipped as well. Pennsylvania now, by 15,000 votes, the latest update, 15,000 votes. Nevada is actually further away, and Arizona, they're going to give an update today, but really, I mean, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Nevada, it's over. It's over. Joe Biden's going to be the president of the United States. It's over. I mean, Business Insider's called it. Vox has called it. I'm not quite sure what. I mean, Pennsylvania by itself is enough to put him over the top. And it's not like there's any hint that Trump's going to come back there. So I don't know. I just think that I think MSNBC, CNN, and Fox are all just kind of looking at each other. Are you going to go first? Are you going to do it? And I think it's because they don't want to hurt Trump's feelings. I really do. I think they don't want to hurt Trump's feelings. So it was, I had a lot of energy. I biked on over to downtown Minneapolis. That was really nice. I'm exhausted. I can barely breathe. I mean, how am I even standing? I go bike all this way and like I'll walk one flight of steps and I'm winded. I am not a healthy man. I am not, but posted some pictures of the pretty trip. It was always nice to go over to Minneapolis. Quickly, I want to make sure a few things here. First of all, coming up this hour, we're actually going to be pre-recorded for the second half of the show. H.W. Brands is a noted historian out of the University of Texas, and I believe it was Austin. And he has written a book on the Zealot and the Emancipator. It's basically John Brown and because not the relationship between him and Lincoln, but how John Brown's actions affected how Lincoln operated. And it's a very interesting book because you know about John Brown, you know about Lincoln, but you don't know how much the influence of what John Brown did ended up actually impacting Lincoln's decision in regards particularly to slavery. It was a very good interview. We talked to him at length, and this was an interview that we featured on the members only page, but it was such a good interview. We wanted to air that. That's going to come up here in just a little bit. Also, I want to make sure I get to the Minnesota coronavirus update as we speak here. It's not good. It's not good. And I want to remind everyone, Republicans, they're still their main policy is we want people to have the right to get as many people in their community as sick as possible. That's the Republican policy. We want to make sure that people can make as many people in their community as sick as possible, even kill a few of them. That's their priority. More than 1,000 Minnesota hospital beds were filled with COVID-19 patients for the first time in the pandemic, which has caused 2,591 COVID deaths, 170,307 diagnosed infections. 36 more deaths reported by the Minnesota Department of Health on Friday, along with a record-shattering one-day total of 5,454 diagnosed infections of the coronavirus. The state-updated pandemic response dashboard on Friday showed that 1,038 people with COVID-19 were admitted to Minnesota hospitals. 224 needed intensive care due to breathing problems or complications from the infectious disease. State health officials have urged people to stick with a combination of mask wearing, avoiding large crowds, and social distancing in public to reduce the spread of the virus and keep pressure off hospitals. It is pretty amazing, these numbers. It's sobering. Please wash your hands, wear a face mask, avoid large gatherings. You know, social distance, for God's sakes, people. And like I said, I think that there's definitely something that we can put here in regards to this being the schools being back in session and high school football. I mean, because it seems like the minute those things came back, that's where things kind of went from there. So very sad, very sobering story. Got to keep it in perspective, and all my best to anyone out there who is having some problems there. You know, I was going to probably spend a good chunk of today's show analyzing what has been going on with the Biden victory. Let's call it what it is, victory. Joe Biden's going to be the president of the United States, barring something extraordinary. There was a few things, though, that happened, because I wanted to, because I'm happy. And I was tapping down the happiness and the joy inside of me quite a bit. Because I was like, these people are going to be very upset. But then a few things happened. The first one was it Rick Santorum was on CNN and was talking about, hey, let's think about the feelings of the people who just realized that Trump lost. I'm like, wait a minute here. The entire campaign for Trump reelection was F your feelings. Get me more liberal tears. That was their entire message. And not one Republican I know was like, you know, I want Trump to win, but, you know, this is out of line. I don't know of a single Republican, Christian as the day is long, not one who sat there and said, you know, that F your feelings, that's a little out of line. Nope, not one. Then came the Minnesota politicians like Jennifer Carnahan. When changes like that are brought forward by a mass level of multiple states, it does raise questions. It does raise some doubt on the election. There's an eerily exact emerging pattern that makes the vote counting in Democratic battleground states suspicious. Michelle Fischbach didn't win the votes. The Democrats didn't win the votes of the American people. They're just finding votes at this point, which is just, you know, and one of the truth is that's on brand for Minnesota 7, you idiots, you morons. That's your woman. And Stauber, I'm not a lawyer, not going to play one on any conversation by, then defend decline to defend the American election's integrity by saying, I'm not a lawyer. And then I should mention Mary Franson is out screaming about communist, paraphrasing, communist. Then came the unbelievable, an hour after it became clear that Joe Biden's going to become the president of the United States, Lindsey Graham came on out and said, you know, the most important thing we're going to have to do here in this next term is basically look at deficit spending. Whoa! You mean you guys finally woke up from your drug-fueled orgy of deficit spending and realize it's not good, but now all of a sudden the Democrats have to take care of it? Oh, please. You want to stop the deficit? Undo all the crap you did to make it that bad, which means undo those tax cuts for the uber-wealthy. That's where you begin. Don't be looking at the blue-collar workers of America, the lower class, the middle class, to pay for your federal handout to the wealthiest people of this country. Don't do that. But it was finally, the last thing was another Democrat saying, you know, guys, let's remember what good sportsmanship is. And I just said, you know, I'm tired of good sportsmanship only being brought up when Democrats win. When Republican win, it's F your feelings. Got him. And now all of a sudden it's, we lost. Let's make sure you guys are nice to us. No. So, until we get to the HW Brands interview, I'm going to encourage you to head to Facebook on either AM950's live stream or the live stream on Progressive Citizen X and watch as we begin Matt's dance party. You got $19.99? Let's do it here. Let's start it up.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
There we go. You get the long version. This might take... How long is this version?
About 6 minutes.
Okay. All right, we got the 6 minute version of this. We're going to be dancing. I promise twerking as well. All you have to do is watch. Everyone get up and dance. Joe Biden is going to be the president of the United States of America. Yes!
Morning, could have sworn.
out there wondering why we're playing this music. It is, of course, a Friday dance party because it's President-elect Joe Biden. Fantastic there. Let's can we do Lizzo? Do you got the Lizzo handing ready? We got Lizzo. Or Prince. Let's not do the Prince one yet. And that was a slow one, and I can't slow dance by myself in here. It's kind of creepy. You know, very Silence of the Lambs sort of thing. So... there we go. You know what keeps this radio station going? My juice, that's right. It is a dance party, taking you up once again. H.W. Brands, who I'm pretty sure is very happy his book's associated with this show. That's coming up in a moment.
Mirror, mirror, on the wall, don't say it, cause I know I'm cute. Oh, baby. Louis down to my drawers, LV all on my shoes. Oh, baby. I be dripping so much sauce, got a bin looking like Greg Goo. Oh, baby. Lit up like a crystal ball, that's cool, baby, so is you, that's how I roll. If I'm shining, everybody gonna shine. Like this, don't even gotta try.
Now you know.
I like shot and naked better over time.
Now you know.
They just say I'm not the baddest trick you like.
It ain't my fault that I'm out here getting loose. Gotta blame it on the goose. Gotta blame it on my juice, baby. It ain't my fault that I'm out here making news. I'm the pudding in the proof. Gotta blame it on my juice. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Don't even gotta try.
Now you know.
I like shot a nigga better over time.
Now you know.
Heard you say I'm not the baddest trick you like.
It ain't my fault that I'm out here getting loose. Gotta blame it on the goose. Gotta blame it on my juice, baby. It ain't my fault that I'm out here making news. I'm the pudding in the proof. Gotta blame it on my juice. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Party's keeping going. What song you got next loaded up there, Patrick?
We're actually just about out of time on the DJ Matt McNeil show.
We are? I had like 8 more songs ready to go. All right, well, I'll let you keep dancing inside your own spirit and self. Yeah, it's going to be President-elect Joe Biden. And I feel pretty good about that. I need to take a break. All right, so H.W. Brands, the book is the Zealot and the Emancipator. It's a 2-part interview. That's going to be taking you for the rest of this show. People, we got a lot of work to do. We didn't take back the Senate. We got a split legislature here in Minnesota. We got a lot of work to do. But for a few moments at least, enjoy yourself. We won. And Trump is gone. Till Monday. See ya. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Matt McNeil here, the book, The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. H.W. Brands is the author. He is kind enough to join us today. He holds the Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair of the History of the University of Texas in Austin. He's written more than a dozen biographies and histories, two of which, the first American and traitor to his class, were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize, and he's kind enough to take some time with us today. Mr. Brands, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Delighted to be with you.
Is this really your first foray fully into a Civil War-based time a novel?
No, I wrote a biography of Ulysses Grant some years ago, so that took me there. But I'm also a teacher of American history, and so I teach the Civil War, and I teach the era of the sectional division, the grappling with the issue of slavery. So I've been doing this for a long time. So I've been over this ground, although not in precisely this form, not zeroing in on the question of slavery and what to do about it.
It's very rare. I mean, considering how many people have written books, have made movies, documentaries, talked about the Civil War, it's rare that you come across a book like yours, which presents an untold tale. Everyone knows who John Brown is. Everyone knows who Abraham Lincoln is, for the most part. But no one really puts the actions of Brown into context with what was going on with Lincoln at the time and how it drove him. Is this something that you had focused on with your historical education, that you kind of looked at John Brown and Lincoln at that time and had a better perspective of it?
Well, actually, no. So, like everybody else, I knew about John Brown. I knew about Abraham Lincoln, but I hadn't thought of putting the two together in quite this form until I was doing an exercise in one of my history classes, an introductory class in American history, where I sort of asked the students to imagine what they would do had they been alive at the time about the issue of slavery, assuming that they believed, as nearly everybody today believes, that slavery was wrong. Okay, it's one thing to say that slavery is wrong, but what do you do about it? If you're alive in the 1850s, it exists. How do you rid America of slavery? And I thought about the different paths that different characters at the time took. John Brown took the path of immediate direct violence. Abraham Lincoln chose the route of politics. And so it was really a thought experiment for my students. And the way I often pose this for my students is, I'll ask them kind of basic questions that are timeless in their own way. And the question that I posed to them, the one that I posed at the beginning of the book, is what does a good person do when his society is engaged in a great evil? And John Brown and Abraham Lincoln agreed that slavery was evil, but they disagreed about nearly everything else. More precisely, what are we going to do about it?
It's interesting because this is the post-Dred Scott case. That was 1857, if I remember correctly. And
right.
And so you do have – I mean, one of the things I think that is lost on a lot of American history is there's this idea of it's – okay, there's the South on one side, the North on the other side. The reality is there was – you know, this country was really pro-slavery even at the time of this book. And as Lincoln was making his rise, there were still quite a few elements of the government. The majority of the government, I would say, was more on the side of slavery. So these were really outside forces that were looking at not only trying to win politically, but the Herculean task of not only winning the popular voter, becoming the people of power, making change, however that may happen, but being able to do that against such strong opposition.
So I've phrased it a little bit differently. By 1857, 58, it seems to me that it's clear that a majority of Americans, citizens, were opposed to slavery, but opposed in various ways and to various degrees. The thing that unnerved them, and particularly unnerved and outraged Lincoln, was the fact that the government seemed to be in control of people who still supported slavery. And so there was this increasing divide between what most Americans wanted and what the government was doing. And from the position of the South, well, the South was, I have to say, the white South, slaves, black people were not consulted. But the white South thought that they were merely standing up for their rights. And they thought that the Dred Scott decision was all in favor of property rights, and they considered slaves property. And so there was this growing alienation of many in the North from the federal government. Now, the striking thing is that it was the South, more precisely the 11 states that seceded from the Union, that became or tried to be institutionally alienated from the Union.
It was interesting because I interviewed a man who wrote about Minnesota leading up to the Civil War. And there were actual communities in Minnesota who were skirting the anti-slave laws that the Southerners, to get people to invest in lakeside property in Minnesota, they were welcoming in slave owners and telling them, bring your slaves, we won't enforce this. It really is, the mood of the country was, I think that there is kind of this idea of making it so simple today. You know, and just right and wrong. And the reality is that there was such a blurred line in this country that was, you know, on one side you had the people who were at John Brown's level. At the same time, you had a lot of people like Lincoln, especially in the post-Whig party. But then, of course, you had this entire element of, oh, yeah, slavery's okay. We're okay with that. And it was a mess. It was a real mess.
It was. And the incident you point out points out that things were different institutionally in that the federal government had almost no enforcement powers of laws. There were very few federal laws that individuals could violate. And so if the states, as in the case of Minnesota that you suggest, if they decided not to enforce even their own constitution against slavery, the federal government could do essentially nothing about it. And so the United States had been blessed but also vexed from the very beginning with this federal system, where there are two levels of lawmaking and two levels of enforcement. And that was a principal driver that took the country into the Civil War.
Let's, for everyone out there, let's talk about the two main characters in this book a little bit. First of all, John Brown. Why don't you explain exactly who John Brown is and get us to Harper's Ferry?
John Brown was born in 1800. He spent the first 37 years of his life more or less mildly opposed to slavery. He grew up in a part of Ohio where there were slaves that came across from Kentucky. And as a kid, he remembered playing with this young black boy who was a slave. And they just got along fine until one day, the black kid, the black slave's master, for some reason started yelling at the kid and beating him around the head. And John Brown remembered being mystified by this and just thinking there's something fundamentally wrong with this. Now, there were a lot of people who thought that slavery was kind of wrong and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. But John Brown developed a deeper and deeper animosity towards slavery until one day in 1837, following the murder by a mob, by a pro-slavery mob, of an abolitionist editor named Elijah Lovejoy. John Brown decided that he had to take a stand. And so literally he stood up in his church in Hudson, Ohio, where he was living, and said that hereafter I devote the rest of my life to making war against slavery. And so this is what he became. He became, in essence, a full-time abolitionist. And at first it involved helping out with the Underground Railroad and trying to spirit away escaped slaves to freedom in Canada. But the more he thought about it, then the longer things went on, the more he became convinced that only violence would lead to an end to slavery.
Obviously there's the elements of the story of his life, which we know about and get taught in, you know, high school history classes, college history classes, of, you know, the violence that ensued afterwards. What prompted him to try to take over the federal armory, I believe it was, in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. It was Virginia at that point, West Virginia now. But what was the triggering moment for him that said, okay, now enough with the trying to argue my way through this. We're gonna get more violent. I know that he had there had been violence acts he'd been partaking in, but this was a pretty big step to go up against the federal government.
For nearly all opponents of slavery, there had been a feeling that slavery had been cornered in the American South, and the new states that were coming in were by and large free states. And if slavery remained cornered in what's now the Southeast portion of the United States, then eventually it would go away. But things changed in 1854 when Congress passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened more of the what had been the Louisiana Purchase to slavery in violation of the Compromise of 1820, the Missouri Compromise. And then came the Dred Scott decision, which said that Congress cannot forbid slavery from entering any of the federal territories. And a lot of people extrapolated from that, saying that the next decision will have the Supreme Court saying that even the states cannot forbid slavery within their borders. And so all of a sudden, the opponents of slavery felt, oh my gosh, slavery is on the offensive. We thought we had slavery on the defensive. So John Brown first took up arms against slavery in Kansas, this territory that had been opened up to pro-slavery settlers and anti-slavery settlers, where they would go and essentially and actually fight it out to see who would have a majority when the territory of Kansas got around, got enough population to write a constitution for the state of Kansas. And it was there that John Brown, incensed by the refusal, the unwillingness of the anti-slavery forces to really stick it to the pro-slavery forces, one dark night led a small band of followers who brutally murdered five pro-slavery settlers in Kansas. And this is what made John Brown notorious around the country. But it didn't actually answer the true purpose of attacking slavery where it already existed. And that's what John Brown wanted to do at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, now West Virginia. He would seize the arsenal there. He would distribute the weapons to slaves in the area. And then they would take up the weapons and launch a war of their own emancipation against their masters and thereby attain their freedom.
I don't want to get too much into Harper's Ferry. Your description of what happens there is exceptional. And really, it's probably the best laid out history of what happened there at that moment I've ever read. Very well done there. But let's turn to Lincoln. The one thing I love about this as well is we talk about, like I said, we talk about John Brown, we talk about Abraham Lincoln, but we don't generally talk about Lincoln pre-Douglas debates, you know, kind of post. We know he went to Congress and, you know, was kind of, you know, to a point floundering. His political party, the Whigs, had dissolved with their pro-slavery mandate, and he'd become part of this new Republican Party, which was hated in a lot of this country. I mean, they were referred to as the Black Republicans, which was a derogatory term at the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, so here he is. And he's trying to, you know, first of all, let's talk a little bit about what prompted him really to get back into politics. What was his motivator? Because it's once again, his congressional career had pretty much been over, correct?
Yes. He had been interested in politics from the time he was a young boy in Springfield, Illinois. And he went into the state legislature and then he arranged a deal with the local Whigs where he would serve a term in Congress. And he was in Congress in the late 1840s. But then his term was up and he went out, and then the Whigs fell apart as part of the larger sectional divide, and the Northern Whigs and the Southern Whigs couldn't agree, and the party just dissolved. So Lincoln was left without a party and without any obvious way of getting back into politics. He was an ambitious man. He had a laudable kind of ambition, but he always talked about there was a little engine in him that wanted to be getting ahead. So he was looking for a way to get back into politics. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which I mentioned just a moment ago, was his avenue back into politics because it caused anti-slavery groups in Illinois, Lincoln State, and the rest of the country to think that, uh-oh, the tide has shifted. Slavery is now on the offensive. And so we need to organize. And so leftover Whigs and various other anti-slavery groups came together to form the Republican Party. And Lincoln was a charter Illinois Republican. And he thought he had as good a chance as anybody else of getting Illinois' nomination for the Senate, for example, and even conceivably getting the Republican nomination for the presidency. So he started laying his path back into politics, and it was in opposition to slavery, in opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Dred Scott decision. But it's critical. Yeah. It was a political path back in, and that was his approach to slavery. He was going to take the political route. He decried violence. He opposed what John Brown did and what John Brown stood for.
And prior to John Brown at Harper's Ferry, he was having some success at taking this little insurgent Republican Party at the point and bringing him back to national prevalence, correct?
Yes. And in fact, it was precisely the political events that drove John Brown to violence that provided the opening for Lincoln to get back into politics. Because again, it looked as though things were going the wrong way. And it wasn't simply the slavery issue. Well, that was a big one. It was a feeling in the North and in the West that the South simply had too much control. And these were a bunch of arrogant aristocrats, and they need to be put in their place. And so Lincoln becomes the person who wants to represent this group in, first of all, the Senate on behalf of Illinois. But really, when he ran for the Senate in 1858, he didn't think he was going to win. But he wanted to make his name known to national Republicans so they would nominate him in 1860 for the Republican nomination for president, which is exactly what happened.
Let's take a quick break here. H.W. Brands joins us. The Zealot and the Emancipator is the book. We'll take a quick break. Come on back. I'll talk more about the book. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. H.W. Brands joins us. His latest book, The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for the American Freedom, is out. A very, very highly anticipated book out, and I highly recommend it. Mr. Brands, we were talking before the break about the kind of the lead up to Harper's Ferry. After Harper's Ferry, Lincoln, you know, obviously this was a major turn. I mean, it was interesting to, you know, clearly the American people were terrified of something like this, what John Brown did at Harper's Ferry. The exaggeration of what exactly took place kind of gripped the nation. And here is Lincoln trying to put together an anti-slavery coalition, and now all of a sudden, in a very kind of in a modern political, you know, party sort of story, here he all of a sudden has a major scandal that he's being tied to, that he's trying to stay away from. And even some of the supporters that he has are applauding and thinking, OK, that we should be doing more of that. That had to be a real tough situation, and how he navigated it, I can't even imagine.
It was. So Lincoln did his best from the moment he heard of John Brown to say that John Brown is not a Republican. John Brown is not one of us. I am not John Brown. And furthermore, I am not an abolitionist. And this was really important because it might seem like a fine point from our distance. But in those days, being an abolitionist was very different from being simply opposed to slavery. And Lincoln said that although I don't like slavery, under the Constitution, I don't believe I, the President of the United States, Congress, anybody, can tamper with slavery in the states where it already exists. And just as Massachusetts had the right to say no to slavery, Mississippi has the right to say yes to slavery, as long as Mississippi wants. However, in the federal territories that are not states, that's where Congress can say no to slavery, and that's where Congress must say no to slavery. John Brown, on the other hand, was saying no to slavery everywhere. John Brown would not acknowledge the right, constitutional or otherwise, for Mississippi and Virginia and Georgia to maintain slaves. He thought that the moral question outweighed any constitutional question. For Lincoln, it was the opposite. The constitutional question outweighed the personal moral question.
And it should be mentioned, as you talk about this and his desire to separate himself from John Brown, one of the things that you address directly, the idea that's put forward that Lincoln was this reluctant president that I guess I'll try to get rid of slavery. The reality is he had been anti-slavery his entire life. That is something I think a modern interpretation. I don't know if it's to downplay slavery in the South. I don't know if it was trying to do the blue-gray brothers in arms sort of thing. But the reality is he was never really kind of reluctant. He wanted to get rid of slavery.
Well, he wanted to get rid of slavery, but again, he didn't think he had the authority to do it. And one of the sources of the confusion that you identify, and it's definitely there, is that when fighting began between the United States, the Union, and the Confederate States, the seceded South, Lincoln made a point of saying, this is not about slavery. This is simply about the Union. It's about my rejection of the interpretation of states' rights that says that states can leave the Union. No, you can't. And for a year and a half into the war, Lincoln stoutly took the position, this is not about slavery. This is about states' rights, or more precisely, the absence of a state's right to leave the Union. And so later, Southerners, defenders of the so-called lost cause, would say, no, no, the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about states' rights. And they could quote Abraham Lincoln in support of their position. And that was indeed Lincoln's position. It's one of the things also that so frustrated opponents of slavery, including Frederick Douglass, a former slave, a very articulate and very visible abolitionist, who, for my literary purposes, is kind of the link between John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. Brown and Lincoln never met, but Frederick Douglass knew both of them. And Douglass thought that Brown was going too far. And so, in fact, Brown invited Douglass to join him on the Harper's Ferry raid. And Douglass said, no, no, no. First of all, Douglass said, I'm a writer, not a fighter. But secondly, he realized that it was a suicide mission, that no slave in his right mind was going to join this John Brown on what was a lost cause. They'd all get killed. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. So Douglas thought that Brown was going too fast, too far. He thought that Lincoln was going too slowly and not far enough. And so he kept pushing Lincoln after the Civil War began to say, look, this is really a war about slavery. You know it's about slavery. And so you need to bite the bullet and say, this is a war about slavery. And finally, Lincoln came on board and with the Emancipation Proclamation made it a war about slavery.
A hypothetical question for you. Would Lincoln have been able to succeed at getting the presidency if not for John Brown? Because John Brown, it kind of allowed Lincoln to sell himself as a moderate. You know, that, oh, that's the extremist side. We're not there. We're just for, we're against slavery and, you know, and states' rights. Would he have become president? Would he have been successful if not for John Brown?
I think he would have, because Lincoln understood something that actually all sort of professional Republicans at that point understood, that the arithmetic of the Electoral College meant that whoever got the nomination of the Republican Party in 1860 was going to win the presidency. There were simply enough votes in the North and in the West that the Republican candidate would win. So the party was thinking, how can we not screw this up? And the way they could not screw it up was to nominate a moderate, particularly somebody who didn't have a long voting record to defend. The principal opponent of Lincoln, the front runner, was William Seward, who had been in Congress for a decade. And he had lots of votes on slavery issues to defend. And he had made lots of speeches that he had said some things that worried folks that said, oh, my gosh, this guy is too extreme. What the Republicans needed in 1860 was a safe candidate. And Abraham Lincoln was going to be that safe candidate almost regardless of whether there was a John Brown or not.
Very reminiscent of 2008. I mean, the Republicans then had no idea how to run against Barack Obama because he really didn't. So they went after him being a community organizer, which was, you know, a pretty garbage attack at the time. But, you know, once again, you had a guy that didn't have a massive record. So how do you attack a record that doesn't really exist?
Yeah. And the election of 1860 was fought out on straight sectional lines. Lincoln wasn't on the ballot in the southern states. He didn't get a single electoral vote from a southern state. He was elected with a substantial majority of the electoral vote, but with a distinct minority of the popular vote. He only had 39% of the popular vote. So although he became president of the United States, southerners could say, he's not our president. Nobody around here voted for him. And then when 11 of the southern states seceded, they say, see, he's not our president anymore at all.
This you talked about earlier in the interview about putting this to your classes, the moral dilemma of what do you do when basically you're faced with an unignorable moral dilemma that you can't just ignore, you can't just walk away from. And I think one of the things that I reading an earlier interview that you had done, you brought up Vietnam, you brought up George Floyd. And you know, it's I think that this is a great way to put what was going on at that time into perspective, is that you have to look at the fact that, you know, yeah, African-Americans have a very legitimate reason in this country today, taking George Floyd, which, of course, in Minneapolis here, we have, you know, had a front row seat for what happened. The African-American population can no longer just sit by as police officers kill African-American men. And so the frustration you can see, you can understand why they're frustrated. At the same time, most people can condemn the violence and not feel if that's the right path. On the other side, you can't deny the fact that we've had decades of people saying, well, we'll solve this problem politically, and it's just not working. I think that that's when you can do that with history and what you've done with this book, I think that's so important because it makes it relatable in that you can put it onto today's kind of arguments of whatever's going on and realize, oh, this was somewhat similar to what the force of the decision they had to make back then.
Yeah, that's part's true enough. It's important to keep in mind, first of all, that things that happened in the past are never so close to what's going on today that they'll give us direct instruction as what to do. But secondly, the history is full of ironies. And the big irony in the story that I write is that John Brown, who had openly embraced violence and was trying to start a war to end slavery, failed utterly to start that war. And none of the slaves in the vicinity of Harper's Ferry joined him, and it just fizzled. And he was captured, tried, and executed. Abraham Lincoln, who did his best to avoid a war over slavery, was the one who wound up leading the country through the biggest war in its history over slavery. So there's no way of telling ahead of time how these things are going to turn out.
This book is so wonderfully researched. How much time, I mean, how many years were you working on this book? Because you've got access to a lot of letters here.
Yeah. So it's a hard question to answer precisely because, as I mentioned earlier, I teach American history. So I've been teaching the story of John Brown and Abraham Lincoln for 35 years. And so I knew most of the story. The question is, what particular perspective am I going to take on these two individuals? And how am I going to get inside their heads? How am I going to employ their voices? And that's where the letters come in. I'd known about the Lincoln letters. They're one of the most famous collection of letters in American history. John Brown letters are less well known. But he turns out to be a remarkably articulate, forceful individual in his letters. And one of the hard things for me to figure out and then to convey to readers was, what was the source of this guy's charisma, his magnetism? People were drawn to him. Even people who disagreed with him fundamentally on the issues had to admire his sincerity, his conviction.
The Zealot and the Emancipator, John Brown, Abraham Lincoln, and the Struggle for American Freedom. H.W. Brands, this is an exceptional book. My highest recommendation on this. Sir, by all means, anytime you have another book coming on out, it would be an absolute privilege to have you back on the air.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. H.W. Brands joining us, The Zealot and the Emancipator. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Making out.